This is Intersection. I'm Crystal Chavez, filling in for Matthew Petty. The Maria migration to Florida continues with no end in sight. One of the first stops for some of the evacuees is a nonprofit billing itself as the Puerto Rican Embassy in Central Florida. The organization Latino Leadership has been serving families at its Puerto Rico Family Response Center in Orlando in coordination with the Florida State Hispanic Chamber of Commerce. Maruchi Guzman is Executive Director of Latino Leadership. Tell us what services are offered at the response center.
Sure. So beyond an initial hello and a warm hug, we're doing all of the wraparound services that families need in order to get integrated into the community when they come. Whether it's connecting them with housing opportunities, employment, we have an emergency food pantry, we have a clothing closet that we're able to give families whatever clothes they may need. Just whatever services kind of dependent on the family and what they specifically require.
I saw on your Facebook you have 50-plus people coming a day. How do you keep that pantry stocked?
We ask a lot. We reach out to the community. It's 100% community-driven. So daily you'll see a family come in with three boxes. You know, you'll have somebody that drives up. We have Telsa properties down in South Florida. Every time they come up to do business here in Orlando at some of their properties, they'll call and say, hey, what's short in the pantry? What do you need? So the community has really stepped up to kind of be that voice for the community.
How many people, do you have an idea of how many people have visited since Maria, this relief center?
Our relief center, we have served in person, online, over the phone, Facebook Messenger, more than 5,000 families.
And your organization went on a relief mission to the island following Maria, right?
Yeah, so we joined a group of about 23 other former military, CIA, current police officers, firefighters from Florida and Texas to be on the ground and provide whatever help we can. So while we were there, we were able to take provisions to five different communities, interact with government officials in Puerto Rico to see how we here on the island, or here in Orlando, can be helping those back home.
Were there any ties between families in that trip that you noticed?
Sure. So I alone, my husband and I, he's a state legislator here in Florida.
Who is he?
Representative Plasencia.
Okay.
So we went and visited my grandfather. He's 90 years old. He's still in Bayamón. He refuses to come to Orlando as much as we ask and plead. That's his home and we understand it. But like us, there were other police officers that had family that they were able to, you know, take a two-hour trip to go and see, make sure that they were okay, and then come back to the group. So obviously, when you have such a big Puerto Rican community in Florida prior to the hurricane, that tie back to the island is something that you can't shake at any point.
Right. So the relief center is new, but have you been serving the local Puerto Rican community for quite a while?
Yeah, I was actually in a meeting yesterday, and that's the conversation we were having. So I don't think, unless it affects you on a daily basis, people weren't aware of that growth, of that influx of families prior to Maria. So we have an autism center. It's a fully bilingual autism center here in Central Florida. And the majority of our clients are Spanish speaking and their families from Puerto Rico. So we have seen through our housing program, through our English classes, through just our normal day-to-day wraparound services, that influx. The majority of our clients prior to Maria were Puerto Rican. Obviously now after, they're overwhelmingly Puerto Rican. So that's something for us that hasn't been new. And I think that's what allowed us to transition so seamlessly into the emergency response with our families.
The people coming in, some who've just lost everything, can you tell me a story about a person or a family that sticks out to you?
Oh, wow. There's so many of them. So I would say there was a young lady that came to the center. She was there with her mom and her brother. The mom had her own health conditions. The little boy needed to get enrolled into middle school. And the more the 22-year-old was talking, she was able to share with us her health conditions. And she has cancer, but not just any cancer. She has tumors on her spine and some of her organs. And the whole time she was talking, she was more concerned about her mom and her brother, what they were going to do. We know currently they're at a hotel because of FEMA. They have a voucher and they're good until January. And then when you think about a family like that and you think, what is it? Like, what are the answers? What can we do? Obviously, we want to house everybody, right? If we had a magic wand, we'd create housing for everybody, but that's not realistic. So, you know, the majority of the families are able to come, you know, interact with their families that are here, with friends, be able to be in a home, you know, even if it's on a couch, you still have shelter. Those families that are the extended stay hotels, they are the ones that worry me. Come January, February, March, when those vouchers expire, then what? What happens to those families at that point?
And you've told local and state leaders you've actually met some people sleeping in cars?
Oh, absolutely. Yeah, we have quite a bit of families that have interacted that maybe when they came, a family member or a friend had brought them in. But you have to understand the dynamics of our families. And a lot of families that maybe already live paycheck to paycheck, they've offered to take in additional family and friends. Now that's put a strain on their finances. So eventually you say, you know, this isn't working anymore. You know, we don't have the capacity to keep you in the home. So then what do they do? So we have some families that at the beginning were living in a car, maybe rented a car for a week. We were able to either place them through a program into housing, or we took on the cost of housing for a few families that we knew that if we didn't do that tonight, they were going to be on the street.
What do you mean? Like get them a hotel?
Yeah, get them hotels. We've also been able to send individuals outside of Florida. So if we know of an opportunity for employment or housing, somewhere that's not here, you know, as much as everybody wants to come to Orlando, we tell them this might not be your final stop. There might be somewhere else that makes more sense for your skill set, for your family. There's jobs everywhere. So we tell them, you know, kind of follow those jobs and make sure that you're getting what you need for your family.
And are you talking about people who are calling you from Puerto Rico that are thinking about evacuating?
Both. So we have people that have come to Orlando and we've helped them figure out their final destination somewhere outside of Orlando. Or families, when they call from Puerto Rico, we tell them, go to where you have family. I know not everybody likes that, you know, but you can come to Orlando and you can struggle until you find work and housing, or you can go somewhere that you have family that helps, you know, facilitate that transition.
More about that housing problem, Marucci Guzman. Did some people not apply for FEMA housing assistance? Are they not giving up enough vouchers? Or what are you hearing that's compounding that?
So I think at the beginning, it was just a lot of no one knows what's going on, right? It was, I don't think anybody realized or could have planned for how big Maria was going to be. Obviously, you know, from just working in the community and knowing the demographics of our community, we knew they were coming to Central Florida, right? So whether it was Orlando or Kissimmee, they were coming. But just the immediate, you know, effect of the hurricane, the grandness of what it was, I don't think anybody was prepared. And that's from all facets of the community. So I just think that, as with anything, just getting that message out and trying to figure out how things work in the best way. Who needs the vouchers for how long, you know, whether it's to the state or it's federal or it was Puerto Rico, it was kind of nobody knew what was going on. But I think now the system has kind of leveled out and people are getting that help.
Leaders figured that the first people who would come would already have family here. But now are we starting to see people coming that don't have family here?
Yeah, actually, that's funny because at the beginning, you're right. A lot of the families, they had, you know, a tia, cousin, somebody that was like, no, come and you can stay with me. But I think as the longer individuals go without power in Puerto Rico, the longer their kids were without school, maybe prior to the hurricane, they had thought of moving, but they hadn't made that final decision. And the hurricane kind of made it for them. They maybe thought, oh, I'll stick it out. But as companies continue to close because they either don't have the money to keep running or people don't have the money to purchase whatever product they were selling, just people kind of start losing hope and they're making that transition.
And you're working with the state Hispanic Chamber. Mm-hmm. Are they helping people get jobs?
Yeah, we have actually on the Puerto Rico Family Response Center website, we have their job bank, and that aggregates all the job listings throughout the United States. So really, employment hasn't been the issue. If somebody wants a job, they're able to find one. I think employers have been really good in kind of working with what people have and meeting them where they are, understanding that they may not have, you know, the three letters of reference because the business in Puerto Rico is gone. So we've really seen the business community step up and be welcoming, and whether it's working with people's, you know, whatever amount of English they know, you know, that flexibility of even providing English classes at their place of employment.
What industries are new arrivals getting jobs in?
Kind of everything. The amount of talent that has left Puerto Rico has been great. A lot of nurses, doctors, teachers. So we've been able to help facilitate those connections for a lot of families. But right now, people are willing to work at anywhere that provides them a paycheck, right? So they need to provide for their families. So we actually did participate in a job fair with the Central Florida Hotel and Lodging Association, and you saw people that maybe in Puerto Rico were a pharmacist, but they're willing to be, you know, customer service here. They're just wanting that employment so they can help kind of fast track their family while they're here.
Do you think this mass evacuation is temporary, or do you think people will be staying long term?
I don't think it's temporary. We were talking the other day that maybe even when they say 60% of the power grid is back up, that doesn't mean 60% of the island has power. Individual homes, people, businesses. So I think the longer that happens, I think if somebody's transition went well here, they came, they found a job, they have housing, their children enrolled in school, maybe they found a church to go to, they've become a part of the community. And I think that's going to be very difficult to go back to the unknown, because that's the issue, right? So they left somewhere. They knew what they left, but they have no idea what they're going back to. They don't know how quickly they can fix their homes, if they're ever going to find work in their same field again, you know? So if you're here and everything's going well, outside of a really cold winter, I don't see the majority going back.
You mentioned churches and people becoming part of the community. Are there any particular churches that are taking in a high proportion of new arrivals?
So I'm extremely proud of my church, Azalea Park United Methodist. We have, prior to the hurricane, we had a thrift store where we did vocational training for adults with autism. After the hurricane, we needed the space, so we took all of that clothes and my church took it in as a mission, and they're giving it out for free. So the volunteers from the church, one of our volunteers, Rachel, they have seen probably about 3,000 families already just at the church that go for basic clothing, for shoes, for, you know, maybe a pot or a pan that they need to be able to cook on their kitchenette in their hotel. So like that, you see churches really stepping up. Whether it's food, we have at lunchtime, we provide lunch for 50 families, a hot lunch. So churches have said, OK, we'll take Wednesday and they'll bring a lunch. So it's been nice to see the community coming together in a way that really supports and provides love for families that desperately need it.
As a grassroots organizer, how do you rate the state's response to Maria and the evacuees to Florida?
I think actually Governor Scott has been pretty amazing. I think you've seen the leadership from different legislators. And I think with the governor's office, you know, with him working on regulations that kind of maybe would have slowed down the process of families being able to get work in their specific field. Teachers are one, nurses, you know, all of that process has really helped families. Having the DMV at the airport so people can get their driver's license immediately, that's big. Because if they had to have gone through the normal process, they probably wouldn't find some of the paperwork they needed because of just issues with communication back home. So I think all those things help. In a time of crisis, when people are already so overwhelmed, something as simple as a driver's license on the spot helps kind of just put you at ease for the rest of what you need to do.
I have to ask you, because you're part of a political family, mm-hmm. and we've been talking about how this new influx who can vote here will impact Florida politics. Do you think people are going to be motivated next year for the 2018 elections to take part?
I think it depends on how they are, right? So our organization started as a voter registration organization, but then we realized that you can't register people to vote if they're hungry, if they don't have housing, if their health
Priorities.
Is off. Right. So I think it depends on the family, right? So I think if you're a professional from the island that came, you found housing, you have a job, your family's good, absolutely. You've already registered to vote, probably when you got your driver's license. maybe a family that's struggling a little bit more, that the transition just hasn't been easy for them and they have other things to worry about. I don't know. I don't know if they're going to have the frame of, you know, of mind to say, oh, right, I need to register and I've already learned the process, right? So it's up to nonprofits, different groups in the community to make sure that we're all educating in a nonpartisan way. Vote for whoever you want, but vote, because obviously power comes in numbers. And if we're able to show, you know, you came, you took an interest in your community and you voted for whoever it was, for whatever your personal reasons are, then that helps kind of move that needle and show, you know, we're here, we want to make a difference in the community, and we care enough to go and vote.
Yeah, so you're on the front lines. What do you think the challenges are going to be for displaced families long term? I mean, what are the immediate needs and then the long term ones?
Sure. So when we started, we always knew at the beginning, in initial conversations with the Florida State Hispanic Chamber, that at the beginning it'd be emergency response, right? So it'd be the food pantry, it'd be the clothes. It would be connecting people with immediate resources. But as they get settled, our focus is going to be on programming. It's going to be doing the work we did anyway in a much larger scale because we have a lot more families. So what we say is, you know, people are talking about 100,000, 200,000, 350,000, whatever that number is. We know we can't serve them all. One, because we don't know where everybody is. We don't know who everybody is. But we do know the families that have come through our center. So our commitment to those families is to be able to expose them to different program offerings, you know, whatever that is, whether it's our housing counselors so they can purchase a home within a year, whether it's job interview skills so that they can find employment, you know, whatever those kind of needs are, if they're looking to restart a business that maybe they lost in Puerto Rico, you know, so immediately, obviously, it's kind of those high need areas, but eventually they're going to settle. And long term, this isn't 30 days, 60 days, you know, this is 3, 5, 10 years. This is something that's going to continue to affect our community, and together in different facets, everyone's going to have to step up and say, okay, you know, this is what our skill set is. This is where we can help. This is what we'll do. Knowing that people are going to continue to kind of need that help and support.
Are people needing any mental health referrals?
Oh, yeah. We've had volunteer mental health counselors with us. We've had four individuals Baker Acton.
What does that mean?
So it's they're hospitalized involuntarily. So we have the amount of trauma that families have experienced has been great. We've had families. We had one individual who saw their father pass away in front of them and they could do nothing. We had somebody else whose mother had died in their home and her body was there for 3 days. The amount of trauma that these families have experienced, you see it in their eyes. When you start talking to them, they start crying. We do a lot of crying with them. You know, we give a lot of hugs because we know at the end of the day, everybody just needs love and they need hope. But right now they're broken. And Florida already struggles with mental health services, with the availability, with the funding for it. So now that we've added more people to the state, it really is imperative that that's something that's continued to light to be shown down on and do something about, because people really need access to healthcare services, mental health services.
So if anybody wants to help, how can they do that?
Yeah, we need volunteers every day. The food pantry needs to be restocked. So we have the Puerto Rico Family Response Center website is prfamilyresponse.com. Individuals are free to go there and sign up either to volunteer. Our contact information's there. The center's address is there. So we're always in need of the community to help kind of come together. Right now we're collecting jackets because of the weather. These are families that probably have never experienced anything under 80 degrees. And, you know, they're going to be cold as Florida gets. But for somebody from Puerto Rico, that's pretty chilly. We're collecting toys for the holidays. You know, there's depending on the time of year, there's always something that individuals can help with. So we welcome all and every person that's wanting to help.
That was Maruchi Guzman, Executive Director of Latino Leadership, talking about the Puerto Rico Family Response Center on East Colonial.
You're listening to Intersection. I'm Crystal Chavez. It's been more than 2 years since an alligator bit off Rachel Lilienthal's right arm while she was swimming in the Wekiva River. I spoke to Lilienthal in October 2015, about 2 months after the gator attack.
So it rolled me around into the water a number of times. At one point, it broke my arm. At one point, I realized that I was not going to get away from this gator by myself, so I called for help.
A handful of people came to her rescue that day. The alligator attack resulted in the loss of her right arm up to just past the elbow. She was right-handed and has had to adapt to a new normal. Just the other day, I stopped by her home to see how life's going. Rachel Lilienthal, thank you for making time for us. How are you doing?
I'm doing great, thanks.
Last time we talked more than 2 years ago, you said everything is slower, that every task takes more than twice as long as it used to. How are things now when it comes to everyday tasks such as brushing your teeth?
Well, I don't notice that certain things are longer if they are. For example, brushing my teeth might be just as fast as a normal person now. I'm not sure. I have a bigger toothbrush and that has solved my problem. So certain things I don't notice that I'm slower anymore, and certain things I'm really speeding up. For example, my typing, last I checked it, it was over 30 words a minute, which isn't bad. Now, it is terrible compared to how I used to type. I think it's actually faster now. I haven't tested myself recently. But I don't feel that it's slow as I'm typing. It's just how I type.
Are you still a Spanish lecturer at Rollins College?
Yes, I still teach Spanish at Rollins.
How have things changed in terms of doing your job?
Well, one thing is that I use less paper. I have my students turn in most assignments online, and I grade them online, and that helps save me the hassle of carrying around papers and passing out papers. And when I do pass out papers, I have to kind of allow for more time. So if it's just turning an assignment to the students to work on, like I'm passing out a test, well, they can take one and pass it. That's no problem. But giving them back their test so that they can see their score and see what they did wrong, for privacy reasons, I can't just have them pass it out. So I have to give them a little assignment to work on while I slowly, one by one, give out the test. So it takes a little bit longer, but I make that work.
You lost your right arm above the elbow, but you still use that arm, right? Describe what you can do with it.
Well, I can hold a bottle with it, and I can use it to...
Can you hold a bottle?
Well, sure. This is a glass, so it will spill, but yeah. I can hold it between my armpit, like basically put the bottle in my armpit so that I can screw off the top or put the top back on. Or just if I need an extra hand, if I need a hand free, I can hold something under there, a paper. I can use it to help me fold clothes. Definitely, it's very useful for holding shopping bags because instead of using my arm, which I never had a whole lot of upper arm strength, so instead of holding a heavy shopping bag with my left arm, which is weaker than it was, it's stronger than it was, but it's probably still weaker than my right arm was since I was right dominant. Regardless, instead of using my arm, I used the strength of my shoulder. And that actually helps maintain the strength of my shoulder, and it makes carrying groceries actually easier. Surprisingly, that's one thing that's easier because bags get heavy.
Yeah, it looks like you have a lot of muscle strength still, or that you work on it. You haven't just, like, not used it.
Oh, no, I use it all the time. I'm very fortunate to have yoga teachers who have worked with me to develop alternatives and work with me on strengthening. So it's always important to engage all of your muscles. But for me, it's extra important in yoga class to use this right residual limb. And I also go to occupational therapy, and my occupational therapist tested the strength, and it turns out I'm perfectly strong here. In fact, there's certain areas, probably from all the grocery bags, where my right arm is actually stronger than my left arm. And that also could be because I was right dominant, but I have no problem lifting it straight up, and I have no problem lifting it forward, but back is, it's a little bit weak. So I've been strengthening there, and she does notice improvement. So that was only recently identified.
We're speaking to Rachel Lilienthal, who survived an alligator attack and is reshaping her life after the loss of her right arm. Stay tuned for the rest of our conversation, including Rachel's advice for anyone going through a life-changing event. Welcome back to Intersection. I'm Crystal Chavez. We're going to continue our conversation with Rachel Lilienthal. She survived an alligator attack more than 2 years ago, and we're revisiting her, and we're starting back with our conversation about whether she still considers herself an outdoors person.
I'm absolutely an outdoorsy person still. I went on a hike just last weekend and found that in Dunellen, there's something called the Greenway, where there are actual hills. So this is my second place in Central Florida that I found where you can get a little tiny bit of elevation, not incline and decline.
Have you tried swimming again?
I have. Swimming I started very shortly after the alligator attack in a pool. Then in the ocean. Interestingly, the very first time I had an opportunity to swim in the ocean, I did not. I was alone. My friends, I kind of came late to the party and they had already gone to the beach and now they were up at the house and they were making food and everything. So I just kind of sat at the beach and I enjoyed the ocean without getting in, which is unusual for me. I live in Florida, but unfortunately not so close to the beach. I'm 1 hour and 5 minutes from my very, very closest beach. And, you know, with a busy life, I just don't get there that frequently. So when I was there, normally I would have taken a little bit of a swim. I really love it. But I think being alone, you know, they always tell you to swim with a buddy. And I didn't think that applied to me. And so now I think I do swim with a buddy or at least with somebody who's on the shore and aware that I'm in. And God forbid, there's just somebody around to help out, God forbid. So, but then the second time I went to the beach, I did go in the water and I've swum in the ocean a number of times. My first time in fresh water was just this past summer. And it's funny because a friend of mine invited me and then invited another friend.
Where did you go?
I went to Kelly Park. It's the Rock Springs. It's actually where the water, part of the water that I was swimming in when the alligator attacked, where that water originates. So, my friend thought nothing of inviting me. Betty thought nothing of inviting me. And then she invited Donna. And Donna said, well, are you sure she's going to want to do it? Is she going to want to get in? And so Betty's go, well, we won't pressure her. Maybe we won't. Maybe we'll do something else. And so they confirmed with me, like, no, let's do it. There's going to be so many people. And when they mentioned that I might be afraid, I thought, huh, I might be afraid. And I said, well, let's just go anyway. It doesn't hurt me if I show up and don't get in. You guys can get in and that'll be fine. But when we went, I walked up to the water and I wondered, is this going to be scary? And I jumped in. It was not scary at all. It was beautiful. It was a perfect day. It was wonderful. It was absolutely wonderful.
And so you went in not in a canoe, not in a kayak. You just jumped in and swam?
Well, it's more of a floating experience than a swimming experience. You can swim or you can float on a water noodle. We brought inner tubes.
So how did you feel after that? Maybe like at the end of it, did you reflect on it at all?
Well, it was actually a really great morning. Perfect weather, great friends. It wasn't super, super crowded when we went. It was a weekday. And by the time we left around noon, it was getting very crowded. So we were lucky there. And it really didn't bother me. Sometimes I like to shock people by telling them that an alligator got my arm. It's, you know, I feel like people wonder. I know that I wonder when I see amputees or people in wheelchairs, what might be wrong with them, what might have happened. So some British people were talking about alligators. And I was like, well, you better be careful. And I pointed to my arm. And so, of course, they're like, oh, no, you're kidding me. And I explained, you know, the story that I was not so far away when it happened. And so one of the people said, and I don't know if it's true, but I don't know that it's false. He said that the last time he was at Kelly Park, he actually saw an alligator in the main swimming area, which is, and he said it was a little one, and it was trying to just get away from the people. So maybe it had fallen asleep overnight, and, you know, people come at 10 o'clock in the morning and wake him up, and he's disoriented. He doesn't know how to get away from the people. I don't know. I didn't see the alligator myself, but I do know that that's their home. They certainly have every right to be there.
What has been the biggest challenge over the past couple of years?
That is a very good question. The biggest challenge. One challenge is learning, like realizing that I have one arm and that that's a condition that is not going to go away. I mean, it could. I am not discarding the possibility of regeneration or of medical advancements. I'm not discarding that possibility. But for the immediate future, this is a reality. I went from being totally able-bodied to having one arm. So that was one mental leap, really, to not be surprised at my state. Because for the longest time, I would wake up and just be like, oh, crap, I've just got one arm. Really? I would just be watching TV and kind of stretch and just like, oh, my arm's not where it should be. I don't have this part of my body's missing, and I never forget that anymore. I'm aware of it. I'm a 1.3 arm person. That's fine, or it has to be fine. But recently, I realized that I'm disabled, and I mean that sounds like that I am going through challenges, and I guess. Yes, I have the 1.3 armed, and I know intellectually that I'm disabled, but I was having a conversation with my mother about some challenge. It was a classroom location challenge that they were going to change the room that I was teaching in. I was like, but don't they know how hard it's going to be? And my mom said, no, nobody knows how hard it is. And so she said, you are having accessibility issues. You need to go talk to somebody. And I never had to talk to somebody about accessibility issues. So many people do for all kinds of different things. And to not be a fully abled person, a fully able-bodied person that can do everything that normal people can do, that's challenging. You know, yes, of course, having 1.3 arms is challenging. But also to have to speak up for myself and say, wait a minute, that's not okay for me. Might be okay for somebody else, but I can't do what you're asking me to do because I am independent, I am strong, I can do whatever.
So now, I mean, and maybe you're not at this point because you're in a realization phase too, but do you have advice for others going through a challenge maybe similar to yours or just anything else that is life-changing?
First, breathe and take your time. You know, there's no rush to the finish line. You don't have to do everything that you used to do. Let things go and focus on what's most important and be grateful for what you do have and pray. And everything will come that you need. I have a few examples since the attack of just being presented with a challenge that I don't know how in the world am I going to manage. And somehow I've been given the ability. And it's one of those ask and you shall receive things. So I had an interesting wound on the back of my leg. And how am I going to, I burnt myself. How am I going to treat this? And so I was arriving home at midnight because I left the place where I was because of this burn. I'm driving home and I'm like, who in the world is going to help me? How am I going to manage this? And so miraculous, when I got home, I was able to dress it. I don't know how I got it. I happened to have all these ACE bandages at home because of from my recovery, and so I was able to dress it that night. And then I go to an urgent care place the following day, and Dr. Roche says, "Okay, well, we'll clean it up. It's perfectly fine. You just need to change the dressings." I think he said 3 times a day, and I'm like, "Are you kidding me? 3 times a day? I'm not going to be able to do that." And then he's like, well, don't you have a family member? Don't you have a neighbor? I'm like, well, yeah, I have neighbors, but am I going to go and be like, you know, dress this wound for me 3 times a day? Like, that's very hard. So he actually asked a nurse to help, and they treated me for the few days where it was in risk of getting infected, and they treated me there. So I was given the ability the first night to treat it myself, and then I was given just kind strangers who chose to go a little bit out of their way and help me out when they did not have to. So I really was quite concerned and, you know, I need help. And I got help.
You know what's so crazy is, like I said, what's your advice? And you said, breathe and pray. And you actually did that in the middle of the attack.
I sure did. Absolutely. Yeah. I'd say that that's good advice for basically any moment of your life, but certainly in a challenge, it's more important.
In the early days after the attack, what did you think your life was going to be like? And then how does that compare to what's unfolding?
Well, one thing is I did not have any idea that I'd be able to use my right arm. It was in crazy pain. And the first time an occupational therapist told me, oh, no, you'll be using this for a lot of things, I didn't believe her. I was like, are you kidding me? To me, it was just this painful appendage that was not useful in any way. So that was one surprise. And I think I figured I would need a lot more help than I actually do. So I'm doing pretty well on my own. I feel like certainly there's challenges. Like, I can't rake. Raking does not happen in my life. I'm not going to rake. And the neighbors might want me to rake, and they can come and rake, but I'm not going to rake. But I feel that it's not actually as bad as I expected.
What are your goals, resolutions for 2018?
Oh boy, 2018. I actually gave myself the gift of raw food for my 40th birthday. So that was a week and a half ago. And I've eaten nothing but raw foods since then, and I hope to continue for my entire 40th year, so basically all of 2018. So hopefully I succeed and feel great and have lots of energy and am very productive. I do want to put my story down on paper, which I started a couple times, and I get in a good habit of writing a little bit every day, and it's hard. It's hard to sit down and write and remember in the details of the event, but I do want to get it on paper. And also, publishing something has been a goal of mine for a long time. So I don't want to put myself, publish in 2018, but write more consistently in 2018 would be another goal.
That was Rachel Lilienthal. She survived an alligator attack more than 2 years ago. Stay tuned for the sweet sounds from Orlando musician Craig Thompson during an Intersection Jam session here on 90.7 News. This is Intersection. I'm Crystal Chavez. Orlando musician Craig Thompson brings the spirit of growing up in Jamaica to the music he performs here in Central Florida. You can find him performing local stages, including bars and restaurants. Thompson stopped by WMFE last year, and I'm happy to rebroadcast his Intersection session. Craig Thompson, welcome to Intersection.
Thank you. I'm very happy to be here. Thanks for having me.
Take us back. Tell us a little bit about your upbringing in Jamaica.
Very, very simple, very different from here. We're very resourceful with what we have, you know. It was very fun. I was always outgoing, trying to do things in the neighborhood. And well, some people would call it mischievous, but I think it is being adventurous.
Listen, you write songs, you play guitar, piano, and bass. How did you learn to play all these instruments?
I self-taught. I was in a performing arts group. And in the group, we had different instruments laying around, you know, piano, guitar. But there were only a certain set of people who knew how to play it. And I was always intrigued by it. I was like, yeah, I want to learn how to play that too, you know. And while I was in the group, I picked up one of the guitars that no one was using. And it had only 3 strings on it. And I learned to play, I actually wrote my first song on that guitar using those 3 strings only. And then from there on, I kind of catch the bug, I guess you could say. And just been playing ever since, you know.
You cover everything from reggae, pop, blues, alternative hip-hop, and more. What are the artists that have influenced you the most?
Number one, Bob Marley, of course. Yeah, I know it kind of sounds cliche, but it really isn't. It's just his message still resonates in today's society, especially what's going on, you know, politically and socially and economically, you know what I mean? The music still live on. This man is a legend in his own right. Bob Marley, Stevie Wonder, Elton John. I remember as a boy, I used to listen to Elton John on the radio every Sunday. Classics, you know. I like the old school stuff.
What's your favorite song to play live?
If I had to choose one, Jano, that hard. I'd probably have to narrow it down to my originals.
Can you give us a taste of some of that right now?
Yeah, I sure can. This is called Medicine Woman.
I'm fed with pain, and my body falls ill. The medicine I need is not in the makeup of a pill. Frail and incoherent, I'm at a loss for all my basic human skills. And so I call upon you, are my medicine woman. You are everything that I need. Yes, you're my medicine and my woman. You're so pure.
distributed. It's not labeled with your polluted ingredients. No, I've got something that's better. That's the touch of your hand. Let me see your lips. The smell of your hair. Said you are, you're my medicine woman. You are everything that I need. Yeah, so you're my, and you're my medicine woman. You're so, you're my only remedy. Yeah.
One thing I've heard about you is that you're such a passionate entertainer, that your voice can touch people of all walks of life. How do you think you break through these social barriers, if they even exist for you?
I treat everyone with the same amount of respect, regardless if you're a janitor or you're the CEO of the company. I don't see faces, really, you know. I try to look for the persons, the positive in that individual.
Well, you can cover almost anyone from Bob Marley to Rihanna. You're working on your very own album, is that right?
Yeah. And that was a little sample of what's to come. And working on a LP, you know? No, an EP, my bad.
Do you have a message or a theme for this album?
Not yet, but there is a message with the album, but I haven't narrowed it down in words yet, you know, but it really... It depicts just my journey through life, you know, to the point where I am now. You can hear the maturity in each song, you know, and over the years, as my writing ability, you know, evolves and the creativity and all that, you'll hear that definitely through the songs, you know.
People sing along with you. You might be doing a wedding and they know the songs to all these covers. Is it scary to put your own lyrics and music out there?
No, man, not at all. You show your creative side, you know. You have to be edgy in what you do. So from time to time, I'll throw some some lyrics that don't belong in the song in there, and people are like, oh, all right, cool. So, no, that's a way of expressing one's creativity. So I'm not scared of doing it at all. You know, maybe others are, but for me, I mean, nothing tried, nothing done. You know, so. That's the freedom that music gives you, you know. You can do whatever you want with it, you know, be creative with it. And so, yeah, it doesn't scare me at all to be creative.
When you're songwriting, is there a certain time of day or a place you like to write, or does that happen for you anywhere?
Recently, I've been having writer's block, but I recently went to Australia, and I found myself wanting to be by the water. And that's where the inspiration just flowed, you know, just like the water.
I love being by the water.
For real, yeah.
Well, you gave us a little taste of your new album. Would it be too much to ask you for another round?
No, not at all. All right, let's see. I got this one. This one here, it's called Spectrum.
I'm not much of your surfer boy, but I do like the beach. Though I am from a tropical place, I prefer the shade of the coconut tree. You like to play in the sand, and I like to swim in the sea. Learn to play football with your hands, and I learned to play with my feet. And a lot of differences or similarities might not be just the type, but there are qualities that you're in search of. Who would have thought you find a love on the other end of the spectrum? Thank you.
Just one last question for you. What's your dream for your future?
Travel the world playing music.
Sounds like the life. Craig, would you mind playing one more song before you go?
I got you. All right. This is Struggling, the first song that I wrote when I picked up that 3-string guitar. Another long night, another sleepless night. Nothing comes through, nothing seems to go right. I don't know what to do to the wall my back is pinned. I'm trying to find my way out of the system we live in. I'm hanging on and I'm hanging to the string. I know someday the string to a given. For sure I don't know when, but I know till then. Stick with this music and I always have a friend. I remember nights before I went to bed. Went down on my knees and my tears I would shed. It's all in spite of things people have said. Most of the negative pushed me to the edge. I'm struggling. I'm hanging on the string. I'm struggling. These walls are caving in. Struggling. I'm learning how to swim. Struggling. And soon I'll have a call of time. I said that girl was mine. She turned out to be somebody else's. Didn't like my style. I tried to keep it real. Told her how I feel. Turned it around and tried to manipulate me. Couldn't keep it sealed. But what you think I'm gonna do, girl? If I can't get through to you, girl, gonna find myself a new girl. You play me for a fool. I can take no more. See, I've been there before. This a door, girl, so go, girl. Can't stand no more. Struggling. I'm learning how to swim. I'm struggling. Treacherous waters I am in. Struggling. I'm learning how to swim. I'm struggling. Whoa. I'm learning how to swim.
That was Orlando musician Craig Thompson. Support for Intersection comes from Florida Hospital and from our listeners. Intersection's executive producer is Catherine Welch. Subscribe to our podcast on iTunes or wherever you get your podcasts. Listen on the NPR One app or visit our website, WMFE.org, to listen back to previous episodes. I'm Crystal Chavez. Thanks for listening.